And I promise you that this was completely unrehearsed, but Randy set us up for our next talk very nicely by talking about the source water protection program here in Minnesota. Definitely, we've been very fortunate. Minnesota has had a very, very strong source water protection for a couple of decades now, and the program is just evolving to new heights of excellence. So that will be our next talk, talking about source water protection. And as Randy said, for most of the audience here, hydrogeologists, source water protection is probably the most relevant part of public water supplies. So we have we'll have three speakers here today who need not a whole lot of introduction at all. Bruce Olson, Bob Tipping, Steve Robertson, who all have made huge contributions to many areas of Minnesota's groundwater over their long and distinguished careers. And they're here today to kind of walk us through how the source water protection program has evolved in tandem with the Safe Drinking Water Act. So with that, Bruce is going to kick us off, followed by Steve and then Bob.
Thank you, Sandeep. As Sandeep said, I'm Bruce Olson, and I'm talking about source water protection today, which is good because that's what I did for a while at the health department. And I thought that, you know, the way to look at this is sort of like with the holidays coming. It's sort of a long and complicated tale, but I'll think of me as the ghost of wellhead protection past, and Steve Robertson is going to be the ghost of source water protection present, and then Bob Tipping is going to come along and be the ghost of the source water protection in the future. And So what I'm going to talk about is the early years of wellhead protection, and before we started looking at surface water-based systems. So we're going to look at the period from 1986 to 2008. And, you know, wellhead protection came about, and the fundamental goal of this program really hasn't changed much. It's really to keep contaminants from entering a public water supply well at levels that present a threat to public health. And so that was kind of a simple idea. It's a lofty goal, but that's where all the simplicity ends and things get to be a little more complicated about that. Let's start again with the types of public water supply wells. Randy Ellingbow went over that a little bit, but, you know, a government always has to kind of subdivide things, and I always say Minnesota has as many public water supply wells as we've got lakes. And there's a lot of them, but we categorize them a couple ways. And there's the community water supply systems that Randy talked about, you know, and those are defined by, you know, they serve a residential user for at least year-round users, or they have at least 15 service connections. And Minnesota's got about not quite 1,000 community water supply systems and that. And there's several thousand community wells scattered around the state. Most of the public water supply wells in Minnesota aren't municipalities or groups that really somewhat used to government. They're non-community types of systems. And the ones the one I like the best about here is called the non-transient, non-community public water supply system, which really defines something by what it's not, right? The non-community water supply systems themselves are non-transient, serve for at least 6 months out of the year the same people. And so these could be like colleges and universities, or not so much colleges, but universities, but large businesses. There could be some colleges on that. And so we've got, quite a few of those systems. And then we've got the most ubiquitous around the state are transient non-community systems. And these are facilities that serve 25 or more people for 60 days out of the year. So these could be restaurants and wayside rests and campgrounds and all of that. And those are the folks that do not view themselves as really being a public water supplier oftentimes. They're businesses, a lot of them. And so you need to try and figure out how are we going to develop some sort of source water protection for all of these. And here's an example of what things were like when I first started. You can see where the well is in the, it's between a fuel tank and a ramp that goes up to some truck. And what's in the truck didn't know. This is actually a picture I got a call one day from one of our district engineers. And he said, we got this issue in this city. And I said, well, what do you think we ought to do about it? And he said, Well, I think what we should do is just have them move the tank. I said, that would be a really good thing. So wellhead protection starts at the well and goes out from there. But there's a couple of things, you know, government never really does anything, especially in a regulatory mode, without some sort of rules or some legislation to help support that. And in Minnesota, we had a couple. As Randy was going over, there were the 1986 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act, and one of those requirements is, excuse me, states had to develop wellhead protection programs. And there was a prescribed components of that and how you were supposed to do that. And Congress, in its wisdom, authorized for the states and EPA to do this, that they would have $20 to $30 million annually for about 7 or 8 years to help support this effort. And they can authorize it, but appropriation is an entirely another matter. And what happened is Congress never appropriated any money for it. So EPA got stuck with trying to make states develop wellhead protection programs and have them approved, but there were no resources to do it. And then in 1989, we had the Groundwater Protection Act in Minnesota. And in that big body of legislation, there were there was one little line that said, Minnesota Department of Health shall develop wellhead protection rules. And so we had a mandate from EPA saying states have to develop wellhead protection programs or we'll do it for you. And then we had the state rules to do that. And then later on in 1996, the Safe Drinking Water Act was amended to add other components to this. So here's what we got. From 1989 to 1997, we were doing a couple of things. We had to put our wellhead protection program submittal, the package together to the Environmental Protection Agency and said, here's how Minnesota's gonna do it. At the same time, we had to put this rule together. And if you've ever done rules in Minnesota, it's sort of a complicated process. You really try to get all your partners together that are gonna be involved or people that are gonna be affected by that rule, come up with some language that everybody can agree to, and then put it out for public comment, and hopefully it doesn't have to go through this long, involved process with having a legal counsel review it, or a judge review it. And we were lucky, Minnesota. We sort of practiced wellhead protection for that period of time from 1989 to 1997. A number of you were involved in different types of activities we had for providing guidance to the health department on how to do this. Some of you were involved in wellhead protection planning and that, and some of you were actually worked for the health department back then. So in 1997, we got the rule promulgated. So that hit the deck and we started working there. We didn't have a lot of staff in that time, but fortunately there were a lot of public water suppliers who were interested in wellhead protection at that time, and we worked with them on a volunteer basis up until 97. And then we had to figure out, well, how are we gonna get all these public water suppliers in the wellhead protection program in a decent amount of time? And so we developed, at that time we started to hire planners. And at that time, planning in the Minnesota Department of Health, when I first started at the health department, I was one of the few geologists on the staff. And by 97, we had about 6 or 8 of them. We only had one planner, so we started hiring planners, and a lot of them used to be planning and zoning administrators, so they knew local government. One thing about source water protection, or even wellhead protection and source water protection, is the health department can work with public water suppliers. We can help, you know, get these plans together, but implementing the plan is entirely another matter. It takes federal, state, and local agencies to do that. So we had to try and work all of that together. And so we had to develop capabilities back then to do that. And going back to 1989, up until even 97, when I first started the health department, not everybody even had a computer in their office. In fact, the ones that were there were these big boxy things, and there were laptops. If there was a portable computer at that time, it was about the size of a small suitcase, right? There was no GIS back then. Cell phones were just coming in, and they're about the size of a World War II walkie-talkie. A lot of the databases that we take for granted today, like the County Well Index or Minnesota Well Index Online and that, weren't available. We didn't have geographic information system support at the health department at the time. So we had to put together all this type of capability in order to come up with this. And this is an example of a wellhead protection area. This is from a drinking water supply management area. The red line in that is a calculated capture zone for a well for 10-year time of travel. And just to get to that point, we had to develop modeling capabilities at the health department, groundwater flow modeling capabilities, and to develop the databases to support that. And then we had to also come up with the rule, people can't see that underground. You know, how do I actually describe where this capture zone is or this management area? And in some areas, add complication to that, we know that there's surface water runoff that can flow over ground, over land, and then recharge into the aquifer and incur contamination into the aquifer in that capture zone. So in some areas where you have a vulnerable well, you have to have what's called a surface water contribution area. That's what that blue line is. And of course, you can't see that very readily either. And so using roads, streets, public land survey coordinates, things that are tangible, at least in terms of people understanding where they are, forms this management area called a drinking water supply management area. Today, when you look at a map, you say, oh, they were always like that. You know, we've always had that capability, but we haven't. It took a long time and a lot of work from a lot of people just to get that far. And once you have a wellhead protection area, drinking water supply management area, you have to do something with it. And so first thing is you have to look at what are the types of contamination sources that might be out there. And those change over time. And oftentimes you're working with local wellhead teams or small size communities. Larger size communities, 3,300 or more, might hire a consultant to help with the contaminant source inventory. But it takes all of these state agency databases that have specific types of contamination sources or potential sources, like underground tanks or even agriculture. But a lot of the land use authority and land use information is vested in local government. And so to try to come up with an inventory of potential contamination sources that might impact your well is actually a pretty big deal. And as I was saying, it changes over time. You have to really figure out how often should I update what's going on with my contaminant source inventory. And so once you have that figured out, then you have to figure out how am I going to manage this. And management of a wellhead protection area, or drinking water supply management area, is going to change over time because land use changes over time. Techniques or tools that we have for managing potential contamination sources change over time. And in addition to that, as Randy was showing, over time now, we also have this litany of different types of potential contaminants that might impact people's health. And so what might be on the books that for a contaminant that has a maximum contaminant level might be last year's news compared to what people might have to be concerned with now. So there's always this mix going on with trying to keep contaminants out of a public supply well, at least to the point where it wouldn't be a present a public health threat. That's assuming you know what the level is for the public health threat. So it gets woven quite intricately. And finally, I was going to end with this, in my tenure up to 2008 here, at least my part of this tale, are source water assessments. In 1996, when Congress reauthorized the Safe Drinking Water Act, they said, well, we want all the states to do an assessment for every public water supply that they have. An assessment had some components to it, describing, you know, the area that where the water is coming from, what are the sources that are out there that might impact it, what's the level of contamination, or are we finding any contaminants in the drinking water and that. And so but there was money that was appropriated at that time to do that. This is the same time that Randy had mentioned there's a state revolving fund, and that if you have a source of money that is the state can put into this fund, then loans could go out to public water suppliers, either at low interest or no interest, to help them defer the costs of making corrections to their system. And so providing money to do that to the states sets up a sort of a bank account that you can use to help public water suppliers meet the requirements they have under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, we got the first installment that came in, the source water assessments had to be done by the year 2003. And we had $42 million, something like that, that came into the state in that first round. And states could use up to 10% of that for doing source water assessments. Now, that sounded really good, but you got to remember that every dollar we spent on source water assessments was a dollar that wouldn't go into that drinking water revolving fund. And so we decided instead of the $4.2 million that we could have used, we decided to do it, see what if we could do it in $2.1 million. And we did. Plus, I think we gave $30,000 back for doing that. But those assessments are still available today. You can see the health department keeps those up to date. And they're based by hitting off a number of these different databases that are have been developed over time to prepare those assessments. And so the getting from 1986 to the year 2008 took an awful lot of time. And sometimes we think, well, here we are today. There's a lot we've got done. Well, we can show all these maps and show the where these source water assessment areas are or the drinking water supply management areas. And we even have it, the assessments themselves also include surface water, which Steve is going to jump on here in just a minute. But we sometimes lose sight of the fact that it took a long time and a lot of very hard work to get to where we are today. And with that, Steve, I'm going to turn it over to you next, the ghost of Christmas or of source water present, and go from there.
Thanks, Bruce. That was a great setup. So I'm the ghost of source water protection current, and I guess, you know, I inherited the program from Bruce's able leadership when he retired around 2013. And I'll say that he would recognize many of the elements of the program that he helped to establish from its inception until the day that he left. But there's been many of the practical aspects of the way in which the program operates. It operates to try to protect sources, drinking water sources, and it does so through a structured and orderly planning process that includes ways in which we identify areas that are supplying the sources of supply to public water systems and doing planning, proactive planning, to try to safeguard against any future impacts from adjacent or nearby land uses. But there's been some changes in the overall environment that have kind of buffeted the program. And some of these changes have resulted in program directions that are a little bit different than what was envisioned early on. And the first is that in 2008, the Legacy Amendment passed in Minnesota. And you know, the highlight, the headline item in the language of that amendment was to protect drinking water sources. So there was an expectation in the lee of the passing of that amendment that more, better work would be done in the arena of source water protection. Shortly after that, there was the 2013 State Government Roundtable that really reset the process for how local water planning is done in the state, and it really set the stage for what we know today as local comprehensive watershed planning, or one watershed, one plan. And that while it isn't directly related to source water protection, it controls the manner in which local comprehensive watershed work is done, and it funnels a lot of state resources to local entities which is of interest to us because it's the local entities that are primarily responsible for carrying out implementation activities on the ground. So that was an important development, and over time we had to evolve and learn how to work within the framework that was established there. And then some of these issues that raised the profile of drinking water in the public profile or consciousness. The Toledo incident that excuse me, that Randy mentioned, the Flint, of course, not necessarily a strictly source water protection issue, but the concerns about lead and equity issues with regard to how drinking water is provided in this country began to rise in profile. And then locally in Minnesota, the 2019 groundwater protection rule that is not a is something that is a rule, a Minnesota Department of Agriculture rule that focuses on drinking water protection and dovetails really nicely with the source water protection work that we're doing in Minnesota. So all these things really acted to create an environment that was going to change some of the way in which we do business. So what have those some of those reactions been? Well, the legacy amendment provided some additional funding through the Clean Water Fund. That's allowed us to add more staff and increased our output. In particular, some of the planning staff that Bruce was referring to, we increased the number of planning staff significantly, which has allowed us to do more engagement, outreach, and implementation work. We've been able, with the additional funding, we've been able to provide financial assistance through grants, no match grants to public water systems statewide to do source water protection work. That's something that really doesn't exist elsewhere in the country. We additionally began to, while the focus of the program in the beginning was on groundwater sources, we began to address surface water more in a more deliberate fashion. And as I mentioned, the increased with more planning staff, we were able to increase our coordination with federal, state, and local partners. And some of that was to try to be more effective in interjecting groundwater and drinking water issues into the local comprehensive watershed planning process, among other things. And we additionally established a new program called Groundwater Restoration and Protection Strategies. It was kind of an analog to what existed on the watershed or the Clean Water Act end of things, the Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies, that delivers data, information, and strategies to local governmental units that are involved in watershed scale planning so that they would have the information to act at the local level to protect groundwater. What are some of the ongoing technical challenges that we face? I mean, we're still involved in trying to protect source water and in many of the same ways that Bruce set up. We use groundwater models to help us do the delineation work and identify where the groundwater sources of supply are coming from. Well, the ways in which we do this modeling work has evolved considerably in the 25 or 30 years that we've been doing this. We've adapted or evolved from analytical element modeling to numerical modeling, from GUIs to Jupyter notebooks, from qualitative to quantitative uncertainty characterizations and analyses. So the modeling, there've been many, many developments on the modeling front, and we've just modernized the way in which we're doing our work so that we can be more efficient, effective, and that the end product is defensible. We've also changed, you know, one of the key aspects of the way that we do our work in source water protection is that we want to know in the area that we delineate the DWSMAs, we want to know how vulnerable the drinking water sources underneath that area are to contamination. So we measure that through vulnerability. And the way we assess vulnerability has changed, also changed over time. Because with the experience we've gained in years of working with vulnerability, we've realized a few limitations in some of the approach. One of the key tools in assessing vulnerability has always been measuring the tritium content of groundwater. And that was great in the 90s, the early aughts, but the signal strength of tritium has been declining because most of that resulted from atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons back in the 50s and 60s. And once that ceased, the radioactive decline of tritium has meant that there's not as much of it in the atmosphere, so the concentration has been decreasing, and so the signal strength is changing. So, you know, one adaptation we can make to account for that is to do ultra-low-level tritium work, but that's expensive. That's more expensive than the simple enriched approach. We also have, and you'll be hearing more about this later today, we've observed that pathogens and certain other kinds of contaminants have been detected in environments that we would normally, through traditional processes, consider to be non-vulnerable. And so that has changed, that has necessarily led to some deep thinking and has changed the way in which we think about vulnerability. And we need to, as more work has gone on in that area, we know that greater knowledge about mixing and low volume, high velocity flow pathways have and could affect the water quality in especially in large public water system wells that may be have a long open interval, and at the top of which you might get relatively young water, and at the bottom of which you might get old water. So understanding of pathways and mixing is important, as well as emerging issues with or understanding of the way in which anthropogenic contaminants are present in public water system wells and what that might mean for protection. And we're increasing the use of indicators that we're using. So, you know, not things like chloride bromide ratios and other more sophisticated tools to allow us to have a series of different kinds of tools to assess the vulnerability. We've always had that, but we've broadened the set of tools that are available to us. So those are some of the adaptations we've made to work on vulnerability. Some of the ongoing program challenges, Bruce talked a little bit about data management. That's with modern expectations about transparency and information delivery. That's is an ongoing challenge, especially in the minute world. Some of the resources we had internally within the program have been shifted to outside of our direct influence or ability. In some ways, our capacity to work with data has decreased, but we've been learning different ways to do that. But expectations for data management have simply increased over time as we're generating more and more data, and we need to deliver that to our stakeholders and people on the ground who can use it effectively. We need to learn to promote outcomes rather than just output. So what I mean by that is we have, over time, defined the progress of the program by how many plans we've completed and how many systems have completed wellhead protection plans. Well, we need to begin to identify the ways in which those plans have produced real protection for the systems that they serve. Is the water quality of the water that's pumped from Duismas different or better than ambient water, groundwater in the state? And so, you know, if we can begin to talk about that in a meaningful way, I think we can really make some progress towards defining outcomes. And we need to, many of the small systems that Bruce was referring to, it starts with the non-community systems, but there's some community systems that are small. We recognize these days that many of those systems lack the capacity and the capability to really be as effective as their larger counterparts in carrying out source water protection work. So we need to find new and better ways to work effectively with those systems and to meet their needs. And you'll be hearing a little bit more about small systems from Anita Anderson later today. And an ongoing challenge is empowering and motivating public water systems. We're a regulatory program. Many systems are, many of the folks involved in source water protection at the local level are involved in many, many other things, and source water is just one of them. And when the streets need to be plowed, that's what gets their attention, and they can afford to put off the protective work, the long-term planning work that may not be a clear and present concern for them. And the landowners, too. Many of the lands within Duismas statewide are in private hands, so we need to have good tools to be able to, and a wide array of tools to motivate them to change land uses. So Some of the emerging issues, you're familiar with many of these from the earlier discussions. The limitations of the Duesme scale is maybe something we haven't quite talked about. Bob will expand a bit on that. Coordination with partners is going to be an ongoing aspect of our work off into the future, because we can develop the Duesmes and the plans, but it's going to be coordination with partners that are going to get the implementation work done. Contaminants are an emerging concern, unregulated contaminants. You'll hear a bit more about some of our efforts on that front later today when Jane DeLambert talks. And of course, climate change is something that is something we all have to think about when we're working with a natural environment. And lastly, although not a front burner issue for source water protection, is the bigger concern is some of the issues within the broader drinking water world that take up time, energy, and space when we're thinking about drinking water, and that is lead, infrastructure, and the treatment aspects for unregulated contaminants, especially in Minnesota, PFAS. So, you know, when those issues are what people are thinking about with regard to drinking water, then sometimes source water gets cast aside. So that's, they're important things and they need to be addressed, but it's we need to do it in a manner that allows progress on parallel tracks. With that, I think I'll see if Bob can ghost of aquifer protection future.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is just share a few images with you and stimulate some of your thoughts about where we're going with source water protection. The first slide here we're looking at is Zumbro Watershed. So this is an area in southeastern Minnesota. I'm showing the Duesmes here, the various places you can read their names and their various sizes. Some very small communities, single well, other ones like Rochester with multiple wells. Point being that as a source water protection, we've treated these Duesmes as our primary focus for protecting drinking water in Minnesota, but there's lots of areas between the Duesmes that aren't currently assessed. This is the same watershed. This is work by Minnesota Geological Survey to put together a geologic model of the subsurface. What you're looking at off to the west, the green is the Decorah Shale, and the dots on top of that are clay sediment. And off to the east, we have Prairie du Chien's uppermost bedrock and the Jordan even outcropping in some places. So the point being is that we understand now at the watershed scale that every place is a little bit different within that watershed, and where water is recharging, where it's discharging. This is some of the work that we can do now based on the databases that we've been talking about so far. Going back to County Well Index, Bruce's work was instrumental in putting that together in the very start. It actually had a county basis of looking at nitrate data associated with water well records. So there's been a close link between water chemistry and CWI from the start. And because of that, we have these tools that we can use now to look at water quality at the watershed scale. I wanted to quickly show this slide again because Steve had mentioned working within the watershed boundaries as part of a planning. Our focus is going to be largely on uppermost aquifers. It's not all the groundwater that's in a watershed, but it's really the sentinel aquifer for most watersheds. The other aspect of that is that these are the uppermost aquifers is where the boundaries of those watersheds can correspond roughly to also the aquifer boundaries. And what I'm showing here are some flow path lines from numeric models that were done for the Zumbro watershed. So the issues of residence time, local, intermediate, and regional flow paths can be addressed with this type of work. Over the time period that we've been looking at changes in water quality, it's the same time period we've been looking at from 1989, what Bruce started with. We can see changes in water quality. On the left is the elevation of water that has elevated chlorides from Rochester municipal wells. This is an elevation of about 850, which is the dam height up on the Zumbro River. That's 1981. On the right is the same well data, chloride levels above background levels in 2011. I can't read that number here without my glasses. But I think that's about what it is. So what we're talking about is a change, in this case, due to pumping. High capacity pumping is a feature here that impacts water quality, drinking water quality, something that we want to recognize. The last point I want to make very quickly is that we have the data. We have the existing data now. We have the pumping data. We have the geology. We have the water chemistry. In terms of mapping that, we also have the capability to put these things on a map. And this is, again, the chloride levels above 2 parts per million, so above background natural level chloride. These are the recent waters that are currently mapped in Olmsted County. And you can see from this slide that they are mostly in the areas out where the Decorah Shale is absent, but also it persists in some areas where it's underneath the Decorah Shale. This type of map allows us to start to understand what's the distribution of recent waters. And if we do that, then we have some idea of what the potential is for anthropogenic contaminants to be existing in our groundwater. It's not everywhere the same. So in conclusions, I just have a series of numbers here to look at. We talked about the transition of wellhead protection to source water protection. Wellhead protection, source water protection still are dealing with the same issues, and that's to protect drinking water for Minnesotans. And so the role that we have played really hasn't changed that much. What has changed are some programs that just initially started this past legislative session, Drinking Water Ambient Monitoring Program, or DWAMP for short, depending on how you like to call it, is dealing with contaminants of emergency concern. And we're also interested, again, look at these at the watershed scale and monitoring the uppermost vulnerable aquifers, because that's where these contaminants are occurring. It's not all groundwater, but again, it provides sentinel monitoring for the most recent recharge. The groundwater restoration and protection strategies that Steve mentioned, GRABS program, this is not an MDH program, it's actually an interagency program to get drinking water as part of watershed planning at the watershed scale. And finally, for groundwater, source water protection is a recognition of the aquifer or aquifers in drinking water source in addition to the public supply well. And that's where we're at. So welcome and take any questions.
Hello, this is Peter Kang from University of Minnesota. Thank you a lot for interesting talks. I have two questions. The first one is, how do you combine the field data, like groundwater age information, with groundwater modeling research, which is like transit time distribution? How do you combine the two information? And that's what I'm curious about. That's my first question. And second question is about consideration of fracture flows. Like, what are the current practices or future plans for taking fractures or conduit flows into consideration when delineating wellhead protection area?
Okay, so the first question about chemistry and modeling, this is the key to the whole puzzle, frankly. We have a lot of modeling. It's never a unique solution from that model, but the chemistry provides us a way to kind of fact check or back check what we think are conceptual models of groundwater flow. So again, kudos to the health department for establishing tritium, for example, as a standard test for vulnerability of wells, just this huge volume of data that we can compare with other types of chemistry like chlorides to establish background levels. So the chemistry is really used to help build the conceptual model. The modeling is the way to sort of raise some of the questions about what that chemistry is showing, and I think they really go hand in hand. So very quickly to address the fracture question, one example of this would be vertical hydraulic gradient. Again, if we're looking at a municipal well that's pumping very hard, it creates a local gradient. When we talked about pathogens appearing in aquifers where there's confining units over the top, that would be one example where we have to consider the possibility of fracture flow. Even the process of drilling that well introduced vertical fractures that could help get water down to that well that we normally would consider as being protected. So we've got a lot of work to do, but we do have data that says water is here and it got from here to there. So trying to figure out how it did it and be able to quantify that is the goal.
I'm Bob Tamman from, or is there going to be more answer?
Yeah, could I just add a little bit to that? That there is, we have a set of processes in place that allow us to identify or that define the kinds of situations where solution fracture or solution enhanced environments may not be an appropriate use for a groundwater model alone. And then we augment the groundwater modeling work we do with hydrologic mapping techniques to better define the wellhead protection area for environments in which fractures or solutions may influence the flow conditions.
Bob Tamman, my wife Pat and I live up on Iron Range, Sudan, Minnesota, and I believe the mining industry in general is supervised by the Department of Natural Resources, but when they drill an exploratory well, I believe the Department of Health assumes responsibility. Now, I believe if a normal Minnesotan abandons a well, you have to go and seal it. When a mining exploratory company drills a well, I believe they have 10 years to let that open hole set there. And so we heard early mention of the implications of mixing, and so I would wonder if there aren't some implications for mixing from those drill holes sitting there for 10 years. And the other question I have, does the Department of Health actually have enough employees to put boots on the ground after 10 years when those wells are being sealed? Are those well sealing activities being supervised? Thank you.
I guess my reaction to that, I don't have a great deal of knowledge about the exploratory boreholes in a mining environment, but I will say that the sealing of old and abandoned and unsealed wells is one of the most common implementation practices that we see happening in drinking water supply management areas. It's relatively easy for folks to identify as an implementation approach, and it's there generally are funds available to help with that. Now, there are resources available to allow MDH staff to oversee the sealing of some of those wells, but I think mostly they prioritize wells that have been public water system wells when sealing is happening. And I'm absolutely sure it's a different part of our program that focuses on that. I'm not sure if they're able to get to all of them or just a high percentage of them.